FM, stream at cfrc.ca, or listen anytime on the CFRC Podcast Network. The Kingston Curator, your backstage pass to Kingston's creative scene.
What's going on? What's the work like? Tanya Dohaskigo, then on the Wadahun Sadache, Ungahuan, and Hadi Wanodas, and the Aboriginal voices, Oscar Dewanyawa Oska, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, the Vinyl Diaries. That next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. And all of that is thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. So today, author Pete Crichton joins me to talk about his memoir, The Vinyl Diaries, Sex, Deep Cuts, and My Soundtrack to Queer Joy. A poignant and funny memoir about sexual awakening, music, and discovering one's true self. We'll find out about Pete's journey to writing his memoir, and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some gay 80s, some queer calypso, and more. All that lies ahead on this journey through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, author Lori Green reads from her book, Drag Queens and Beauty Queens, Contesting Femininity in the World's Playground.
New York Avenue, where the party began. Mortimer breathes deeply and gestures broadly with his arms at the now vacant lots and rundown buildings on the west side of New York Avenue. The Saratoga is here, he points behind us. And the Shea Perry Disco. He turns and walks toward the world-famous boardwalk and makes a right on Westminster, commonly known as Snake Alley, a winding back street that connected New York, Kentucky, and Mount Vernon Avenues in the old neighborhood. The parking lot to the right used to be the Entertainments Club, the oldest bar on the East Coast. Louise Mack, who loved gay people, owned the building, and the bottom floor was her little speakeasy nightclub, which always catered to gay men. It was one of those places where you had to knock on the door and have a code word to get in. Mortimer continues to walk, looking around, gesturing toward two large parking lots on the opposite side of the street, where the Grand Central Hotel and Studios 5 and 6 once stood before they burned down. He laughs as he kicks an abandoned beer bottle toward the curb. Gay rooming houses and hotels once choked the streets here, and it was all gay everywhere. He turns and frowns as he rounds another corner of the ghosts of properties where it was easy to pick up young men for sex and rent boys, especially in the 1980s. We turn onto Kentucky Avenue, where Snake Alley ends, now a devastated parking lot, as he describes the hotels and gay businesses that used to line the west side of the street. On the corner of Pacific and Kentucky Avenues, on the right-hand side was the coffee mill. On the left-hand side, the Atlantic City Electric Company. Across the street was Kelsey's Restaurant. And what used to be a pool hall and pizza parlor, rooming houses, a little gay grocery store. He pauses and points across the street to a small house, which still has a plant in the window. This is where drag queen Sandy Beach lived. Mortimer points to a little window where he remembers losing his virginity. He shakes his head, surveying the empty space. Turning right on Pacific Avenue, we walk past an empty lot, which was once Lyle's, a gay breakfast place where everybody ended up after staying out all night partying. Two prostitutes walk by, followed by their pimp arguing about cigarettes. Turning right, back down New York Avenue, he summons the ghosts of gay clubs once again, the Saratoga, the Shay, the Rendezvous, where he used to perform in drag, and where he saw his first gay sex inside the club, right on the dance floor. On the right side stood the Chester Inn, its restaurant called the Front Porch, and there was an underground club here called Pucolani with a pool. Across the street was an Italian restaurant, Mama Mott's, where he had his first gay date. It's all gone now. Camp and the queering of Miss America. The corner of New York Avenue and the boardwalk in Atlantic City Beach side is the girls' side of the street, the spot where lesbians congregate to watch the parade and cheer as the cars go by carrying the Miss America pageant contestants. On the opposite side of the boardwalk, gay men stand in front of Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum waiting for the parade to begin. This year, there is an added intrigue, since this is the first time an openly lesbian contestant, Miss Missouri Erin O'Flaherty, is competing for the crown as America's ideal woman. Many spectators carry rainbow flags. Some are dressed in drag, men in full makeup, women donning t-shirts with men's chests and muscular arms painted on them. Others wear rainbow kitsch, plastic sunglasses, boas, crystal-studded crowns. Both men and women flirt with local police as they beg to stand pressed up against the parade route and promise they will behave in return. Drag queen Morgan Wells stands in a gown and a headpiece on the men's side. Beside her stands a man shirtless with pierced nipples attached to chains. Gay men congregate, sorted by age and acquaintance, under the marquee of the museum. To their right quietly sits a family with beach chairs and three small tow-headed children on their laps. Shoobies, or out-of-towners as we call them, they gawk at the spectacle before them. The convertible carrying the Miss America contestants in the Show Us Your Shoes parade pass in alphabetical order. They wear costumes whimsically representing their states, with shoes held up in the air with one leg as they lean back in their seats and wave to the crowds. Show us your shoes, is screamed from New York Avenue crowds as each contestant passes. And as they do, most of them met with cheers of encouragement, waving rainbow flags, while others receive sometimes not so flattering critiques of their tepid presentations. You on New York Avenue now, honey. You ain't in Kansas anymore, someone yells in the crowd. A baton-twirling team from Kentucky approaches. The young girls dressed in rainbow-colored leotards draw near, and the excitement among onlookers builds. They all respond by waving their rainbow flags and chanting, twirl, girl, twirl. Twirl, girl, twirl, as they jump up and down and continue to wave their flags. The twirlers, a little disconcerted, perform their number. Flags begin waving and people push in toward the yellow cones along the parade route. Miss Missouri Erin O'Flaherty is dressed in a blue and white baseball uniform and holding up a pair of bejeweled high-top sneakers. As the convertible nears, the cheers increase. She smiles, but she is demure as she waves. Jean runs toward the car waving her rainbow flag. And though Erin smiles and waves back, she appears a bit awkward with this group of locals looking for some acknowledgement of their shared identity. The crowd chants, show us your shoes. Show us your shoes, not your midriffs. Mimi on first stands at the top of the risers as she enters wearing a 12-foot-long purple bejeweled velvet octopus stole with arms wrapped around her torso and dragging down the steps behind her. Hair high in a platinum blonde bouffant, her lips bright red, Mimi cocks her head, turns, and drops the stole coyly, revealing a sparkling black velvet swimsuit and a gold and purple shell accessories. She struts, turns her back to the audience and winks. A finger goes to her lips as if to say, oh my, I'm so exposed. She seems oblivious to her fatness. In fact, she shows a confidence in her superior form, her extra large body jiggling, hands on her hips accentuating her simple frame. Mimi walks down the runway, stopping at the end. She licks her lips slowly, turns, and walks back to center stage, moving her hips slowly to the music. Mimi on first, contestant number one is announced, along with her measurements, 72, 48, 72. The crowd cheers and applauds, and she bends over slowly, paws and bottom to the audience to retrieve her stole. As Mimi is escorted away by Speedo-clad male dancers, the next contestant begins to descend. Farrah Mascara steps gracefully, one stilettoed foot after the other in a sequined red row. As she reaches the stage, her robe falls away, revealing a red cutout sequin swimsuit, fishnet stockings, and a giant lobster clawed hands as gloves. She moves her thumbs, pinching the air, flashing an open mouth toothy smile. She shakes her head side to side, her huge hair just seconds behind her. Farrah struts from one side to the other as she makes her way down the runway, ending in a figure eight, pinching claws held high. She shimmies and jiggles her large body, putting one claw to her mouth in feigned embarrassment. Miss Farrah Mascara, contestant number two. Her favorite food is chicken nuggets. Her favorite color is the rainbow. Farrah squeals and grabs the arm of one of her escorts as the next contestant appears at the top of the risers in a gold lamé robe cinched around her waist. Tina Burner descends in sparkly white platform shoes and reveals her swimsuit, white and skirted, with a gold belt and an anchor and gold tasseled epaulets on her shoulders. Tina's ginger hair is coiffed 1950s style, and she holds a captain's nautical cap, posing, one knee bent, arms by her side, wrists flexed, head cocked to one side. She walks slowly to the top of the runway and puts one white gloved hand to her mouth as she knocks her knees together and giggles. Tina Burner, contestant number three. Her favorite perfume is fishy.
Glenday Bookshop started in Gerald Moldenhauer's backpack around 1972. Gerald figured that to build community, we needed access to our history, our culture, our literature, our porn. He started schlepping books and magazines from one queer event to another to sell. As the collection got bigger, he moved it to a hall in the commune where he lived, in an old house on Seton Street in downtown Toronto. In those days, to see the books, you needed to phone first to make an appointment to come over. Glenday finally opened a fully-fledged store in the late 1970s, and that's when the more public profile started causing problems. An issue with the Canadian book business is that a lot of titles are published elsewhere and therefore need to be imported, and that means they all have to pass through Canada Customs. And Canada Customs in those days was not about to let dirty, smutty, queer literature cross the border to corrupt innocent Canadians. Glenday started having books seized and shipments blocked starting in 1977. It got worse in the 80s. Even The Joy of Gay Sex got banned as obscene. And even if books got through customs, they were still not safe. In April 82, police raided Glenday and charged employee Kevin Orr with selling obscene material. And that wouldn't be the last raid. Glenday was embroiled in court cases for years. Some American publications actually started producing special Canadian editions with pages blanked out to get them across the border. In 1983, partners Bruce Smythe and Jim Deva started a gay bookstore in Vancouver called Little Sisters. Little Sisters was soon experiencing custom seizures as well. What was infuriating was that big mainstream bookstores were now importing and selling many of the same titles without a problem. It was just small, gay-run bookstores that were being targeted. Little Sisters also fought the custom seizures through the courts. But it took years and thousands of dollars before the Supreme Court finally decided that the seizures were a violation of the Charter of Rights. That was in 2000. Customs still had the right to stop materials, but the onus was on them to prove they were obscene. Customs censorship finally began to grind to a halt. By this time, queer material was widely available, and the digital age meant that borders were being largely irrelevant anyway. But today, both Gladday and Little Sisters continue to operate as bookstores. Gladday is actually the oldest surviving gay bookstore in the world. So if you are in Toronto or Vancouver, be sure to check them out. They're part of the living history of our community. This is Tim McCaskill, author of Queer Progress.
Coming up next, The Vinyl Diaries.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Rise Up by Toronto's own Parachute Club was released in the summer of 1983, celebrating peace and tolerance with the instruction, rise and show your power. It was a top 10 hit in Canada from coast to coast. The band was a big collective of musicians with strong female membership and was fronted by a queer woman, Lorraine Segato. They were an eclectic mix of funk, reggae, pop, and more. Rise Up was quickly adopted as a protest song, and it is rumored that the first public performance of the song was at Toronto's 1983 Pride Parade. I first heard the song while watching after-school music video programming. All my friends went home from school, turned on the TV, and watched CBC's video hits to see the latest and greatest of all sorts of genres. We were blessed to live in a time when pop, rock, alternative, metal, ska, and more could all live on one channel, oftentimes within the same half hour. As the years passed, Rise Up took on a different meaning for me. One of the friends with whom I had watched the video on television was the daughter of Dr. Henry Morgenthaler's lawyer. Morgenthaler was a healthcare practitioner who provided safe abortions to women at a time when doing so was illegal in Canada. Providing a valuable and much-needed service got him in a heap of legal trouble, but it was his defense that ultimately went to the Supreme Court and struck down the anti-abortion law in Canada. But that was still several years away. In 1983, the fight was very much on. As a result of this friendship, I got pulled into a variety of causes and conversations well over the head of a 14-year-old boy. But somehow, I knew this one was right. I think I had already recognized myself as an outsider and realized that all of us had to band together to fight for what was right, that the rights of all people matter. In September 1983, a group of my young friends and I decided to attend a pro-choice rally at Queen's Park to support Morgenthaler and add to the voices demanding change in Canada, advocating for a woman's right to choose. There I was, pictured in the Globe and Mail, holding a placard that stated, "Every child, a wanted child." As an adopted kid, the weight of the message seemed appropriate. Here I was, surrounded by protesters of every kind. Feminists, queers, friends, humanists, all. The odd thing was, I never questioned it. I was terrified of my attraction to other boys. I was terrified of being identified as an outsider. I was terrified of showering after gym class. I was terrified of everything. But here, among this crowd, I felt at home. And I wasn't the least bit terrified of being pictured in a national newspaper at a pro-choice rally. A budding feminist queer was born. I was ready to rise up. Before the protest began, a familiar tune started up to get everyone into the marching mood. It was Rise Up. The song didn't really grab my attention on after-school TV. I felt it was too poppy, aimed at a mainstream audience. But in this context, it all made sense. This massive group of lefties and weirdos all started dancing and singing the lyrics, demanding social change. Rise up now. Show your power. I had started to find my tribe.
Pete Crichton. Hi, how are you?
I am great, Mark, thank you. How about you?
I am well, I am well. Thank you for being here, to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this, especially to talk about you. You. You have your memoir that's out. It's called The Vinyl Diaries, Sex, Deep Cuts, and the Soundtrack to Queer Joy. My Soundtrack to Queer Joy. That's a full title.
It is a full title. It's a lot of punch.
So let's start from the ground and build up. Talk to me about the message that's at the heart of your story. What are within the pages of The Vinyl Diaries?
Oh, golly. There is a lot in the 336 pages, I think, the book entails. I really, you know, look at it as a celebration of my record collection, for one, my love of queer sex and connection, two, and a sort of analysis or look at what it was like for me growing up just under the shadow of the HIV/AIDS crisis, because I was born in 1969, sort of too young to be sexually active when it was really at its peak, and sort of what that did to me as development as a gay person and a sexual person. Spoiler alert, not great. It sort of touches on all those things. My love of music. We talk a lot about the artists that affected me and a little bit about their histories. We talk about many of the men I met, some casual connections, some longer-term relationships, and really dig into those connections and what each of those men taught me, and really just look at my life and how I developed as a queer person over, you know, the time period of the book is when I'm about 45 to 50.
So you just mentioned you essentially came of age in the 80s, in the shadow of HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. You also write about hiding your sexuality and finding comfort in music. So talk to me about what it is about music that drew you to it, that gave you comfort, as opposed to, say, like in books or in movies.
Sure.
Why music? Why do you think you were drawn to music in particular?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. My mom will tell you very early, very, very early, I just would hear music and I would dance and I would be alive in a way that I wasn't in the normal world. And that, I think, is still true for me today. It's a bit of an escape from a different world, or escape to a different world. It's like a religious experience, for lack of a better sort of analogy. And why I think it was really my escape during the HIV/AIDS crisis is it really was a world I could control. And I went from being like a lover of music and dancing in my little room by myself into really purchasing a lot of records. I spent a ton of time on Yonge Street as a teenager buying records from long gone record stores. And Sam's and A&A, the most obvious, but okay. Do you remember Cheapies? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like the place for the UK imports and the 12-inch mm-hmm. singles for like Tears for Fears and The Cure and Depeche Mode that I have lots of. That was a favorite spot for sure.
And then did you ever go to the vinyl? Was it called the Vinyl Museum?
The Vinyl Museum, definitely. He stamped those strange, like, there were some like psalms or religious messages in some of them stamped in ink, which kind of creeped me out. But they're still there. And there was a store called Vortex. I don't know if you remember Vortex. It was on Dundas, fairly close to Church and or Jarvis. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was all used records, and you could buy like the most amazing stuff for $3. So I did. I bought a lot of that stuff. But at home, just by myself, I could, you know, alphabetize it and listen to it and read the liner notes. And it just was like a world so far away from the bedroom in my parents' basement. It just was absolute transformative for me.
So in your memoir, you link your partners, your lovers, your one night stands to music artists and songs, artists like the B-52s, you've got Prince, the Smiths. When I say Kate Bush, the Hounds of Love,
yeah,
who or what comes to mind?
Oh man, I can't identify just one person or one man to that song or that album in particular. It's been so important to me since, you know, I first heard it in 1985. I listened to it today. Like, it's a record that touches on so many relationships in my life, but I guess most importantly, just mine and my relationship to Kate Bush, who I love dearly.
Would you say that you were a hound for love as opposed to like a hound for sex?
Oh yeah. Definitely when I was first dipping my toe into gay sex and connection, it was an irrational fear, absolutely, but I was so terrified of HIV and AIDS. I was certain that just having sex, I would get it and that I would die, you know, and much of the messaging made that seem so real for a lot of my peers and myself. So the idea of like really exploring my sexual identity when I was in my teens and early 20s and even into my 30s was just so terrifying. So I was a hound for love for sure, and a hound for like finding a partner that would be monogamous, that would play heteronormative roles and sort of create this marriage dynamic in a way that made sense to me at the time, which I then found really stifling in the end. But
the idea to link your partners to music and musical artists, what's the genesis of that particular idea, and where does that come from?
I think, you know, it was definitely a eureka moment writing this book. It really cracked open how I would approach talking about some of these relationships and some of my sexual adventures and partnerships. But I think we all do it, don't we? Like, don't you have, you know, either from your early loves or at college, or you stayed up late and listened to this record, and that record just brings those emotions back to you in a way that...
And those people and those experiences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that happened, like, to me, it becomes alive. Like, I see the colors, I see what I was wearing, I see the wallpaper. Like, for me, it's very clear. And I think maybe other people aren't quite so specific, but I think those emotions that we feel come right back up, and a song and a record can do that and just bring us back to a time and a place and a relationship that both good times and bad times.
Mm-hmm. In your memoir, you write about your relationships. You had two long-term monogamous relationships. And then by your 40s, you find yourself single, being out in the world dating again, dating apps, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you think that gay men and being in relationships, same-sex relationships between two men, do you think that men have to navigate relationships differently than other people, like two women or a man and a woman, because it's two men? Do you think that and monogamy and maybe, you know, negotiations around monogamy or the lack of monogamy, do you think that two men have to navigate relationships differently than others?
It's a great question. My first gut instinct is yes, absolutely. And I'm trying to think of why it was such an initial gut reaction.
Because maybe men are more sexual?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think men define themselves by sex in a way that maybe women don't. You know, I don't think this is true for me, but I think sometimes a lot of it is based around ego, proving to oneself that they can do it, you know, and I don't think those things are true for women at all. You know, men get caught up in the conquest, I think, and puffing out their chest
and other things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm losing my train of thought a little bit, but I think definitely men having sex with men and men having relationships with men approach it very differently than other partnerships. Mm.
The title, the vinyl diaries, sex, deep cuts, and my soundtrack to queer love. Is there a story behind
queer joy.
This?
Queer joy.
Is there a story behind this particular title?
Honestly, I have my editor to thank for the vinyl diaries. I was really struggling with a title. And as soon as he said it, it just was like, of course, that's what it's called. And like in my mind, I was playing with vinyl as a concept and sort of like the duality of like vinyl for sex play and vinyl for records and sort of how to tie that into a title, but I just couldn't crack it. And so, Scott, my editor, just emailed me one day. He's like, what do you think of this? The vinyl diaries, sex deep cuts, and something. I can't remember what he had suggested. And I was like, yes. And then I was like, no, it's a queer joy. Like, for me, you know, the book is so joyful that I really wanted that right in the title.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hello, Canada. I'm Jen Trujillo, one of the co-directors of Gilbert Baker Film Festival, GBFF, an international 2S LGBTQIA+ film festival that was started in honor of the man who created the original rainbow flag, the late great Gilbert Baker. As a festival and community, we celebrate, amplify, and enjoy 2S LGBTQIA+ authentic stories on screen and the creators who bring those stories to life. We connect a global film-loving community via pop-in discussion groups, watch parties, Q&As, networking, and social events, which allow for our Gilbies around the world to be seen, heard, valued, loved, and respected. Please join us for our upcoming festival run, which will stream online, globally, and virtually on Eventive from late June all the way through the end of August. Find and connect with us at GilbertBakerFilmFestival.lgbt to learn more.
So as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener-supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell, and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, Pete Crichton, you were a marketing executive. You've studied comedy at Second City. You're now an author. So here is the question. The Dolly Parton Choir.
Yeah.
What is the Dolly Parton Choir?
Mark, how do you not know?
I don't know. I mean, obviously know who Dolly Parton is, but there's a choir around Dolly Parton?
There is. Based
and
in
where is... Really?
Yeah. There's an event that I write a couple times about in the book called Steers and Queers, The Night of a Thousand Dollies, which is the brainchild of my now friend, Lauren Horty. And it's a night devoted, it's really campy, it's country and Western themed, there's a ton of different performances. And every year, I think since day one, there has been a choir that sings a cappella to a backing track to several Dolly Parton songs every Pride. So I joined maybe, oh my gosh, 6 or 7 years ago now. And it's, as you would expect, silly, but super fun. We take it seriously. I can't sing worth a hoot. So, I hope I just, my voice gets lost in the beautiful chorus of people celebrating Dolly Parton.
So you're part of the Dolly Parton Choir. You were saying when you were younger, you'd be dancing around to music and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When you were younger, did you want to be a performer? Did you want to be in the performing arts at all?
Oh, man. I watched Fame, both the TV series and the film, and, like, that was my dream, was to go to that New York Performing Arts School and, like, fling myself around and dance on the roof of cars. Very much a fantasy of mine. But then the reality of actually being on stage and doing the work and being in the spotlight was something that really made me uncomfortable, which I think is why I'm a writer today. I can sort of hide behind my computer and just type away and not be in the spotlight.
In your memoir, The Vinyl Diaries, you write about your time in school when you were bullied, being called names. Why do you think you were picked on?
I guess it was so easy. Like, I was this really small kid for a really long time. I liked playing jumpsies with the girls. I liked playing games with them because I didn't like sort of the aggro behavior of boys, even at a young age. That's that whole sports thing. And, I didn't fit into that stuff. And so I think those behaviors, for better or for worse, still are identified as being gay or less than. So it became, and it didn't help that I did gymnastics for a while. So that also was a clear marker for my classmates anyway, that I was a young gay boy, and they told me all about it. in not kind terms.
Mm. So you think you were picked on because you were gay?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you know that about yourself then? Maybe not necessarily the words, but...
the words were thrown at me and I didn't understand what they meant particularly. But I knew I was different. I knew I didn't belong in the world that I was living in. It's a pretty alienating feeling, which so many of us queer people have when we're growing up, is like, you look around, it's like, where do I fit in here? This isn't for me.
And any thoughts about that time growing up and being bullied in school? Do you think that those formative years influenced or made you who you are today? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, golly.
Had you not been bullied, had you not gone through those experiences, do you think you would be a different person than you are today? I mean, who knows, right?
Who knows? It's a really interesting question.
Because are we shaped by the experiences of our past? And I would think, yes.
I would agree. I would agree. And I think, you know, I can be pretty defiant and I can be pretty stubborn. And I think those things are direct results of that experience. For a long time, it was definitely, I just buried my head in the sand and I didn't want to address that. But I think, you know, when you finally come out of the closet, you get a little bit of confidence. And for me, that took a couple decades. It didn't happen overnight.
And how would you hide who you were sexually?
Just not doing it, I think, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I think.
But did you have, like, girlfriends or friends that were female that you said, like, hey, this is my girlfriend, when she wasn't necessarily?
No, I didn't do that. I never played that game. In high school, I had a grade 9 girlfriend and a grade 10 girlfriend, and those were they were very innocent. But after that was, very much, I was just sort of the class clown, I think, for a long time. And I thought for a long time, it's like, oh, I'll just be a bachelor, that old age word from back then, that he's just a wacky bachelor. But then, I did finally come out when I was around 21 or 2 to a couple close friends. But even then it was, I was gay, but I wasn't a practicing gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was me for a long time.
When I say the word guilty, what comes to mind?
Well, the Barbara and Barry song, of course. It's the first thing that comes to mind. I'm not sure you're talking about the emotion, but definitely the song, that pure, golden, cheesy, wonderful, campy song.
From 1980?
80, yeah.
Barry Gibb produced her album, Guilty. I believe it's,
He wrote it, too.
I think he co-wrote, like, most or not the whole album or something.
He did the entire album, and his brothers had a couple co-writes, and a producer named Albie Galufin, I should know it, it's in the book, who produced, like, Islands in the Stream in the 70s, helped a little bit on a few tracks. But it was almost all Barry Gibb's writing and producing that made that ridiculous and amazing record. I love it.
So who's that about?
A gentleman...
Or scenarios surrounding it.
Yeah, it was sort of one of those, it's a gentleman named Ian in the book, and he's based on a real person, and who is a lawyer and a poet, and we were on this date, and we're just like not connecting on music in a way that was making me happy, and then all of a sudden Guilty came up, and, he was a very big Barbra Streisand fan, which I am not. I'm a bit of a traitor to my people because of that, but Guilty was the one place we could find some common ground. And we had amazing sex, we had amazing conversations, but I was like, oh no, he likes baseball and Barbra Streisand, what are we going to do? And then Guilty saved us.
Mm. And did you feel guilty about it?
God, no. 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 That's where my defiance and stubbornness comes in my taste of music. I'd never feel guilty about what I like or don't like.
Why did you want to tell your story? Why was it important for you to share who you are?
I think, you know,
especially so publicly.
Yeah, I mean, that's now it's terrifying. It seemed like a good idea before I got a book deal. But, you know, I had always wanted to write a book, but I never knew what about. And these experiences were so extraordinary to me and so surprising to me, not just the sex, but the level of connection and deep sort of friendships and mentorships that evolved out of those relationships. I really wanted to document it first for myself. And then I wanted to share it because I hadn't seen that kind of story. And I wanted other people to read it and go, oh, wow, I can do that. And, oh, wow, people in middle age are sexually vibrant, not just active, but like having a great time. And I just sort of thought, why not be honest about these things and give people a different view? And it is scary. It is really, really terrifying, Mark. But it just felt like, well, why not? If I don't do it now, what have I got to hide at this point?
Most challenging aspect or part about telling your story?
It's hard. Like, just digging up all that old baggage around being bullied, around all that hysteria around HIV/AIDS, the messaging around that and how scary it was and how confusing it was. And, you know, revisiting that stuff was really hard. It affected my life at certain times, not terribly, but I was like, why am I in such a foul mood? Why am I so upset this week? And it's like, oh, because I'm writing about age-old trauma that I've experienced. So, I'd say that was definitely the hardest part. And then making peace with people reading it is the next hardest part, but it's coming out and people are going to love it or they're going to hate it, but I really hope they love it.
And the best part about telling your story?
There's a freedom for sure. You know, I spent so much time hiding who I was, and even as a pretty, you know, 40 years old adult, you know, so many of us hide a lot of ourselves in our lives when we go to work or when we go into situations, that whole idea of code switching where we just sort of like turn off a certain part of ourselves. I did that for so long. And now it's just, there's a real freedom of just like, this is it, you know, this is who I am. And there's really, as you know, I'm bearing a lot in this book. So there's not much else to hide, and that feels great.
You write about saying that, if not all, but some of these individuals are maybe amalgamations, or you've changed names.
A couple, yeah.
Why did you choose to do that?
You know, a lot of the men, like, I'm still very good friends with a lot of the men, and most of them were just like, Yeah, just use my name, tell the story, I don't care. Some I hadn't been in touch with, so didn't feel good about, you know, using names and or situations that people didn't give me permission. And then some were just hybrids, like, because there's a character called Martin in the book, and he's definitely a amalgamation of very similar experiences with a certain number of men. That all were sort of bringing up the same things around sex and intimacy that I wanted to explore without naming anyone or writing six different stories that all kind of sounded the same. So it was sort of like, take little bits of this from there and there from there and pack it into one story.
Were you a clubber at all? Did you go out to dance clubs or anything?
Not really, because that's not my style of music. I really don't love the divas. I don't love a disco mix of a track. And so a lot of the bars and clubs that I went to in the sort of late 80s, when I was first sort of exploring that stuff, really left me dry because the music just was not it for me. So, you know, I think I just missed some of the more radical alternative stuff that was happening in the 2000s in Toronto, especially with Vaseline and these parties that were like really celebrating weirdo queer punk stuff and live music and alternative acts. And, you know, by then I was sort of playing house with a partner and missed a lot of that stuff. So I do have regret there that I wasn't part of that scene. I think I would have maybe come out and explored my queer identity a little bit earlier if I had seen that.
Did you ever go to like Nuts and Bolts or anything?
I did. Nuts and Bolts, I think, was actually one of the first clubs I went to when I was like 15. Because back then,
it was more like alternative, the music.
That was true. But that wasn't specifically a gay club, was it?
It wasn't. It was mixed.
That's okay. Yeah. So that I did go there. I would go into RPM. There was a place called Orange Crush near my house. And, you know, you're 16 and I looked 13. There was no, they just let you into these places and that was fine. So I do remember going to Nuts and Bolts and liking the music there. But, and most of the queer spaces I went into were very sort of diva driven dance mixes. And that wasn't so much my cup of tea.
So here's my last question for you. And it's simply this. What do you hope your audiences come away with, your readers come away with after they've read your memoir, your story, your life story, The Vinyl Diaries?
Yeah, I mean, one of my biggest dreams is that like people read about the artists and my love and exploration of why I love them and are inspired to go listen to some of that music that they may or may not have heard. And I just hope they see something of themselves, maybe, and just, or a better understanding of, you know, their next door neighbor who might be gay, or their brother who might be gay. You know, those two things would be really nice results.
Well, Pete Crichton, well said, well done, well written. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark. It's been really fun talking to you.
50 words for snow. I knew I should encourage Preston to go home, but we were enjoying each other's company so thoroughly, I wasn't ready to end our date yet. 50 words for snow came to mind, and I asked if he'd like to smoke a bit of dope and sip a scotch while I played him a record. He was game. 50 words was a gamble. Preston had proven himself to be a very eager student for almost every record I had played him, including some Kate Bush songs from her commercial peak. But 50 words is different. It takes some patience to reveal itself. But he was an artist. I was confident he could handle it. I was nervous as I got up and dropped the needle on side one. We sat entwined on the couch with our tumblers of scotch and waited for it to begin. The album starts with a 10-minute song, Snowflake, a duet between Kate and her prepubescent son. Preston was a piano player and was immediately drawn to Kate's playing. But as the song slowly, almost imperceptibly built, I could see he was falling for Snowflake. Hard. His eyes opened, practically bulging, and he looked at me with his mouth agape. There were no words this time, but it was obvious. Wow. After only a few minutes in, I could tell he was absolutely smitten. At the conclusion of song one, we finally spoke, briefly. This is one of the most incredible pieces of music I have ever heard, he told me, as he put his scotch down and got up to retrieve his notebook. He was so overwhelmed, he was visibly flustered. He needed his notebook to start writing down some of his thoughts and feelings about the work, to calm himself as he played. Song 2, Lake Tahoe, trumps song 1 by exceeding 11 minutes. It's about a ghost woman searching for her lost dog on a frozen lake. Song 3, the entire second side of the record, goes one step further, with a running time of over 13 and a half minutes, and describes a love affair with a snowman come to life. And so it goes. Not for the faint of heart. The songs are ostensibly about snow and winter, but I hear so much more in them. In each simple lyric, a world unto itself. The playing is masterful. Kate's piano is restrained but exquisite, filled with meaning. Her backing band are total pros too. A combination of musicians on guitar, bass, drums, and backing vocals. They are with her every step of the way. The mood is cold, but it draws you close, almost looking to the listener for heat, for warmth to survive. Feelings of loss, memories of love, and thoughts of love lost are all inescapable, but only if you pay attention and listen, really listen. And we did. For just over 65 minutes, we sat in wonder and let four sides of a quiet but complex work wash over us while we cuddled, held hands, and very slowly, very quietly, sipped our scotch. In a world full of noise and distraction, to sit in a candlelit room with a 23-year-old man and drift away to Kate's world was an extraordinary luxury. That night was magic.
That was my spotlight on author Pete Crichton. His memoir, The Vinyl Diaries, Sex, Deep Cuts, and My Soundtrack to Queer Joy is available wherever you get your favorite books. For even more on this author, you can find him on socials. Simply search Pete Crichton.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. Rise Up, The Parachute Club.
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through this summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mac, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Yvonne and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town on September 27th. And then Yukon Blonde gets us into the fall spirit on September 28th. All shows are all ages at the Broom Factory and co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM. For a complete list of shows and tickets,